From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. For the second time in 3 weeks, the U.S. government shut down, just for a little while, though, apparently. Another thorny issue, immigration, remains unsolved. Turbulence in financial markets as stocks swing up and down, mostly down. Poland has signed a law dealing with the Holocaust, and it's got a lot of people upset. And amid all those difficult issues, something nice for a change, the Winter Olympics have begun in South Korea. Well, let's start with the all-too-familiar story of another shutdown of the federal government, the second one in 3 weeks. But it seems this shutdown was actually pretty short-lived. For our global listeners, there's sort of a phrase we use here in the United States, the devil is in the details. When it comes to the budget deal that apparently has been crafted, what are those details? We'll start with you, Tom.
Well, basically, it's a two-year budget deal, and I think the reason there is a deal in the first place is because both sides got a little of what they wanted, or one could say a lot of what they wanted. President Trump got a huge increase in military spending, I believe about $165 billion increase. And the Democrats got far more spending on domestic programs than they ever thought they would be able to get, over a $130 billion increase. So this is one of the rare instances of some bipartisanship dealing in the Congress, and maybe this will be an omen, but it probably is not an omen. It's probably an aberration. But basically, neither the Republicans nor the Democrats had the votes to do what they really wanted to do without help from the other party.
Didn't you find, Tom, that that came from out of the blue? Because all the talk had been about immigration. There'd have to be a compromise on immigration in order to avoid a government shutdown. And then the two Senate leaders, the Democrat Chuck Schumer and the Republican Mitch McConnell, announced that they reached a deal over something else, spending caps for the next 2 years. How did that happen? The White House wasn't involved, was it?
No, the White House was essentially irrelevant in this negotiation. They have signed on, of course. President Trump signed the legislation. But the White House was not really involved in this. But you're quite right. There is no deal on immigration. And immigration status of 700,000 younger illegal immigrants expires on the 5th of March.
Well, we're going to get into that in greater detail in just a second. But, the interesting thing here, and I'll ask this one to you, Dan, is that, President Trump came into office about a year ago saying that, things were going to run smoothly. His administration, he has said, is a well-oiled machine. And yet we've had on his watch, and the Republicans, it's important to note, control both chambers of Congress, two shutdowns in about a month. Is that a well-oiled machine in your view?
Well, he can't control everything, and that's certainly something that Donald Trump learned. Still not an expert at it, that's quite clear. But the White House still is proud of the year 2017, because just before the end, they got a tax cut passed. And that, they say, is going to revive and push the American economy. Here in 2018, they said that their main goal at the start is going to be infrastructure and getting Congress to approve a lot of spending plus public-private partnerships. So that's quite a goal, but you have to learn to get along with Congress. I think he's still learning.
Well, and on that note, talking about these big budget items like infrastructure, and a lot of people say that this big tax cut bill that is now, of course, the law of the land will add something like at least $1 trillion in red ink. And that's, of course, before infrastructure spending. Where's all this money going to come from, Tom?
The White House and Republicans, for as long as I've been covering politics in this town, always say, if we cut taxes, consumer confidence will kick in, Americans will spend more, businesses will expand, they'll hire more people, there'll be more businesses starting up, and the revenues, the added revenues from all this expansion will just magically wipe away the deficits. I've heard this for 50 years. I don't think it's ever exactly happened, and we all should hope it does happen, but that is the scenario. So the answer to your question is more red ink.
Now, what that means, as I understand it, I'm not an economist. Paul, you write a lot about finance and business. So let me see if I got this right. What the U.S. government will have to do is either print more money. Literally, you can create dollars by printing all those dollar bills in hundreds.
Which means inflation.
Well, yes, that causes inflation. It means that the U.S. dollar is worth less if you print a lot of it. You are devaluing your currency. Or borrow money, which means selling a lot of U.S. government bonds to Chinese, Japanese, Russians, anyone around the world. And then you get complaints here in the U.S. that the U.S. is a debtor nation because we have to somehow repay all those bonds that folks around the world bought. Either way, it's problematic, but it does kick the can down the road into the future.
Well, and the other problem with that, of course, is to sell these bonds to other countries, the Japanese, Canadians, and Chinese, and so forth. We have to offer them a higher interest rate to get them to invest while we're going to pay for that one way or another. So on that happy thought, gentlemen, let's move on to something that you were talking about a minute ago before, Tom, and that is immigration. There is still no immigration deal, and there is, to use this phrase, DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, something like 700,000 people who came to this country, mostly as children. President Trump has said he wants to put them on a path to citizenship, but he's also sweetened the pot, saying he wants to possibly put a million other people as well on a path to citizenship. But that kind of offer doesn't come without a price now, does it? So what does the president want in return for that?
He has a four-point program, of which DACA is one. He wants a border wall on the southern border with Mexico. He wants to eliminate something called chain migration, where if you have a illegal alien who is put on a path to citizenship, he or she can sponsor other members of the family. He wants to curb that severely. He wants those things, and he wants really to have less immigration across the board.
Yeah, the other step is the end of the diversity lottery program that he says, what? You just sort of pick a lucky number and you get into the U.S., which again, immigrants' rights groups say is a terrible way to describe it, because it's true that people around the world, and a lot of VOA listeners may know, that you can win that lottery, and that's a chance to apply to get into the U.S. You're still going to be vetted or checked. But in any case, the Trump administration really wants to do away with it. But it is worth considering. There have been some terrorist incidents and certainly some crimes in the U.S. where if you look at who the perpetrator was, it was someone who got in on one of those immigration programs, like family reunification, or his parents were winners of the lottery. Trump is offended by that, and he says that means those are dangerous programs. We don't need it. Now, you can call it bias, prejudice, or just electioneering, trying to firm up his political base. Either way, he's determined to get rid of those two programs.
The bottom line is you're not going to get a deal on immigration unless both sides are willing to compromise. But the real problem is there is a right wing in the Republican Party who hates immigration generically, and they are already screaming about the path to citizenship.
They can't believe that their president is suggesting that.
Yeah.
By the way, Tom, let's be honest here. Do we think that's basically racism, populism, nationalism? I mean, is there an easy label for it? Or most Republicans actually calculate that those immigrants are most likely to become Democratic Party voters, so we don't want them ever to become citizens.
Well, that I think is the essential political calculation. But if a deal collapses and the president doesn't extend this DACA program, which will expire on March the 5th, and starts deporting these young men and women who were brought here by their parents as infants or three-year-olds or six-year-olds, I think that will be there will be a real storm on that, and that will cost the president politically. So let's see what happens.
I'm going to end that on a note with this observation. If you look at sort of the data around views on immigration, what I find really interesting, gentlemen, is that people who live in areas where there are the fewest immigrants tend to have the most harsh anti-immigrant views. And people who live in areas where there are lots of immigrants, New York, California, Florida, and so forth, tend to have more lenient attitudes toward them. Very interesting kind of a disconnect.
There's several Republican members of Congress from Iowa who have perhaps 1 or 2% of undocumented workers.
And they hate it.
They loathe it. Some even say President Trump should be impeached. This is an outrage. But you're right. I would add to your list, Paul, Arizona, which has hundreds of thousands of these people, and even Texas, where former President George W. Bush has said we can't run an effective economy unless we are allowed to let these individuals in. Because Americans won't take these sort of jobs that these undocumented workers will.
All right. Well, let's take a short break. More issues in the news in just a moment.
This program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. And a reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News. And Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is Paul Brandis, the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. The U.S. stock market has taken quite a tumble in recent days in absolute, not relative terms, but in absolute terms, two of the biggest drops in history. Why now, and what, if anything, does this mean, Tom?
We in the U.S. are now have met the classic definition of a correction. A correction in the market is generally considered to be a 10% drop. Well, the stock markets have blown through that. Why is it happening? I think I am obviously not a market analyst, much less a mogul, but clearly I think a lot of people, a lot of bankers, investment bankers, and others believe that all of a sudden they're worried about inflation, and that consumer spending has been strong since the tax cut was passed. And the feeling is that the Federal Reserve may feel the need to raise interest rates more quickly than they were projecting. Well, they were already projecting 3 interest rates at a minimum this year. And that has created a lot of jitters in the stock market. So it's fear of inflation. If inflation gets worse and is left unchecked, that could really put a halt to the expansion, to the recovery.
Because inflation, of course, eats away at the value of your assets and reduces things like purchasing power. So people are worried about that. You know, Dan, President Trump has used the stock market as sort of an example in his first year, at least, to show how successful his administration is, how well things are going. But he's been rather silent about the stock market in the past week.
Well, we noticed this past week that he, in fact, was not on Twitter much. For him, a lot less than usual, as though he was sort of hanging back, not sure what to say on a few issues, but they included the stock market. Because you're right, in his first year as president, he frequently would start a speech by saying things are going great, the economy is going to be booming, and we know it because we reached another record on Wall Street. And he would talk about how the Dow Jones average had done. And then when it started going down about 10% in the first days of February, nothing at all. But other White House officials said, we have our eyes on the long term, and the overall economy is strong. As you know, stock markets tend to fluctuate. In this case, by the way, largely just another element, a little technical thing that people who are real experts invested on a bet that there would be no volatility. All of last year, stocks didn't fluctuate much, and there's a thing called the VIX that you can invest in, and it stayed low. It stayed low, and so people were taking a bet on that. When suddenly volatility came back to the market and there were some big fluctuations in February, those people suddenly had to sell and raise money elsewhere, and, well, that's largely what caused it. It's not even rational about how American companies are doing, because I just want to slip in. Again, I like to say this with listeners all around the world, United States corporations are doing very well. And a lot of the quarterly profit numbers came out in the past week or so, and generally they were strong, ahead of expectations. And that's why I think the White House is still expressing confidence that the economy basically is good and growing.
in the
volatility for people who might not know is just a term meaning that things can kind of swing up and down rather wildly and unexpectedly, which is what that means. Tom, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, Paul, that in the month of January alone, President Trump boasted, rightfully so, boasted about the strength of the stock market 25 times, almost once a day. Yeah. And when this meltdown for the moment or correction occurred, he went silent. And he should have been a little more careful because nothing goes up forever. The question is this a correction? There were 5% corrections in the market last year, and the market came roaring back by the end of the year. So the real question is this just a correction, or is this the start of a bear market? Now, most...
A bear market meaning a 20% drop.
25%.
And a market that's heading downward. We've had a bull market. That's the good one. Since the year 2009, we've had a bull. That's a long time.
Yeah, so far, the analysts, the experts, seem to think this is a necessary but horrible occurrence, this drop of 11%. But what we don't know, and nobody can know, is whether this is a floor, whether this is as low as it goes. All we know for certain is there's going to be increased volatility, and investors are going to have to get used to that because I don't think that's going to go away.
And set against the backdrop of something that you mentioned, Dan, stocks have gone sky high since 2009. That's an awfully long time to shoot up without the kind of pullback that we've seen. So a lot of people say, look, this is very natural. Prices sometimes get a little bit ahead of themselves, so it's perfectly okay. But the question I have about that is, you know, we live in this interconnected world now. Whenever stocks here in the United States fall, often we'll see stocks in Asia and Europe fall as well. It's this interconnected world. And that, in fact, is what we have seen. Is this something that the world should be concerned about, or is this, again, sort of a one-off kind of...
Well, everybody should be concerned about it, but I think this is a one-off. You just don't know. I mean, when there's a cold on Wall Street, markets around the world will get another case of the jitters as well.
And vice versa.
Absolutely. But that's
our interconnected world, right? There are good aspects to that, but when it comes to things like investments, it's not so good. What, there's a problem in one country? Why should that affect all markets? Well, we are talking about the United States. We're still the biggest market when it comes to investments.
All right. Well, moving on, Winston Churchill, quite a transition here. Winston Churchill called it, quote, a crime without a name, but it does have a name. It was called the Holocaust, of course. It was the systemized murder of millions of people during World War II, most of them, of course, Jews. Much of the killing took place in death camps in Poland, which Nazi Germany occupied. Now, three-quarters of a century later, Poland has enacted a libel law to punish anyone who accuses the Polish people of complicity in this monstrous crime. Now, that's got a lot of people here in the United States, in Israel, even Holocaust survivors, and there are still some of those around. They are quite upset about this. Dan, why?
Well, experts on the Holocaust, including some who lived through it or their parents or grandparents, managed to survive the fact that the Nazis murdered 6 million Jews, as well as killing lots of other innocent people in Europe, say that, unfortunately, there were a lot of Polish people who helped the Germans. And there were people in other countries, too, who helped the Germans. And historians, you know, want to point that out. Poland, on the other hand, feeling very nationalistic and proud of itself, wants to point out the Poles who helped Jews, who hid them, who tried to oppose the Nazis, who took part in resistance groups. Were there more of these or more of those? Good people, bad people? Maybe there was a mix. And so, especially to Holocaust survivors, and also to the state of Israel, the Jewish state, it's offensive that there's a country, Poland, that wants to erase part of history, that won't allow honest history to be written as to how people behaved and what was the nature of the anti-Semitism and mass murder. So offensive, and Israel had good relations with Poland, and Poland's in the NATO alliance, and Poland has reason to even worry now about its relations with the United States government because the Trump administration is aware that Jewish groups and Israel are unhappy, and the Trump administration has really taken their side and has tried to put pressure on Warsaw, don't pass this bill But Poland did pass it.
Well, they passed it, but it has to go to a constitutional court, which will be the final authority on all of this, and perhaps there could be some changes. You can be sympathetic in a slight sense with the Polish government. They seem to be particularly offended by the phrase Polish death camps. Now, we all know there were death camps in Poland, but the Polish government is saying they weren't Polish death camps. That's a libel and a slander. But I think the Polish government, which is increasingly becoming more right-wing, is gone overboard on this one, and it will probably have a chilling effect on free speech in Poland, and it's troublesome. It's troublesome, and it's not smart. And the notion that there was nobody in Poland involved in helping the Nazis is just not correct. You know, I was at Auschwitz with President Gerald Ford in 1975, and you see all those rail lines coming from Krakow, coming from Warsaw, and the Germans were in charge, but they weren't running all those death trains. And so it's denying a historical record, and it does not make Poland look very enlightened, which is very ironic because millions of Polish Jews perish as well.
Right. Well, finally, shall we end on a more pleasant note? The Winter Olympics are now underway in South Korea. What's interesting is that even the North Koreans are participating in these opening ceremonies, the South Koreans and North Koreans marching together under a unified flag. The backdrop, of course, to all of this are these nuclear tensions between the United States and North Korea. Is this sort of an opening, perhaps, for the U.S. or for South Korea, if they can reach out to each other and diffuse these tensions?
Well, I think there's a little bit of a tension between the South Korean government and the Trump administration, because the Trump side thinks that the South Koreans are a little too soft on North Korea. The president of South Korea thinks there should be more rapprochement if that is possible. Still, Secretary of Defense James Mattis came over to the White House a few days ago, and in a refreshing burst of candor, he said, with respect to North Korea, we are firmly in the diplomatic lane. So President Trump has talked about all options are on the table, including military. And Mattis, who is one of the grown-ups in the Trump administration, is saying what most Trump people feel, which is we've got to find a way to avoid this. Now, it may not be possible. On the other hand, this reunification via the Olympics, although it will be temporary, there's a feeling within the White House that maybe this will give Kim Jong-un the craving and the attention he needs. But I think we've got a long way to go to defuse this.
And on that note, Dan, quickly, you know, even President Trump has said that if conditions were right, he'd be willing to talk to Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader. Are conditions right now, or what would that look like?
Well, that was a significant statement. A lot of people didn't take it seriously, but when you see what's going on right now in South Korea at the Olympic Games, where a younger sister of the North Korean dictator is there at the Games, she was part of a meeting with South Korean officials. Sure, the U.S. Vice President Mike Pence is there, and he doesn't seem quite comfortable with the idea. He was repeatedly asked, will you meet with North Koreans? And he said, we're going to take a very hard line. We're pointing out the human rights abuses in North Korea. We're demanding they give up their nuclear weapons. But indeed, South Korea's President Moon Jae-in, who only came into office last May, and always the U.S. government thought, indeed, he's a little bit too soft. He wants to talk to the North. You know, we don't want that to happen as a general U.S. point of view. But you can't stop the Koreans from doing what they want to do. And I think you're right, Tom and Paul, you've noticed too, the U.S. push toward military threats has subsided, at least for now.
Although we hear that they're asking the Pentagon for these options on a possible attack. So have they really?
The Pentagon has always asked for options, literally to invade every country on Earth. There, listeners, do you feel better about that? But it doesn't mean that that's the way the U.S. is heading on the North Korea issue. It seems right now, give diplomacy and talks a chance, right now.
Okay. Well, we'll have to end it right there. Our thanks to Tom DeFrank. He's contributing editor to National Journal. And Dan Raviv, national correspondent for the Israeli channel I-24 News. This program was produced by the Voice of America Current Affairs, our engineer, Justin Thwaites. And I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports. Thank you very much for listening.